Hey everybody, it's Tuesday at 4 o'clock. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. We're also having all our shows downloaded on our terrific website, www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Please check it out. Please also go on it and register so that you get our weekly email, coming attractions from our producer, Krista McMillan. Today, very exciting show. The main guest is going to be Kathy Moore, who's the executive director of the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. I think a lot of us know that there's been a big discussion of domestic violence centered around the National Football League, but it's kind of ironic because the discussion of domestic violence is happening in so many homes in the United States for hundreds of years before and unfortunately many years in the future. So besides talking about the NFL, the main thing we want to talk about here is the actual work that people do, because at Voices from the Front Lines, we're very interested in opinions and analysis, but we're also mainly interested in work. Who's doing something about it? What are you going to do about it? And that's why we go to the people on the front lines who are waking up every morning and going to sleep every night thinking about it. And more importantly, doing things. So I'm very happy today to be talking to Kathy Moore. Kathy, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Very glad you're on the show. Obviously, we want to talk primarily about the actual work that you're doing at the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. But maybe tell us a little bit about what brought you to this job. You've done it for over 20 years. You've been in many, it seems like, parts of the women's movement and dealing with so many different issues. What brought you to the particular issue of domestic violence as your life's work?
That is going back a ways, but I think that I had been involved in social justice and volunteering work all the way, you know, back in high school and throughout college, and it was a required internship in my social work degree in my college years. That's when I landed in a domestic violence shelter, the first one I'd ever worked at. And I knew going into that experience, it was a year-long internship, I had a feeling it would be a life-changing experience, and it truly was. I knew I was kind of scratching the tip of the iceberg. I wasn't necessarily steeped in feminism and domestic violence or sexual assault at that point, but I knew it would really suck me in, and I've been in the field ever since.
Well, that's really great. I mean, there's been a lot of consciousness raising in my life, and just one story is I was working at the General Motors factory in Van Nuys, California, as an auto worker and as a revolutionary organizer who went in there consciously to build a movement of auto workers. And fortunately, in this factory of 5,000 workers, 2,500 Latino and about 1,000 Black, and interestingly, 15% women. And this was one of the best jobs that women had ever gotten, which is women in production. And, gee, we were making $12 or $15 an hour and with overtime and everything. And I got several of the women involved in this so-called campaign to keep GM Van Nuys open. In the process, I learned maybe for the first time about the level of systemic violence against women, and that many of the women in the factory were victims of domestic violence and still coming into work every day, being attacked by their spouses for making more than them, being attacked by their spouses or partners for allegedly flirting with people at work, you know, seeing really amazing women coming in literally black and blue and then still having to work on an assembly line and build a movement to keep Van Nuys open. The great thing is they had jobs, and they had good-paying jobs. And still, we learned a lot about a place called Haven House, which I had never heard of before, you probably do, where a lot of the actual leaders of the movement in the factory had come out of Haven House. So it was quite an experience, and it's shaped many other of my issues since then. So thank you very much for the work that you're doing. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what is that work? What does it look like?
Yeah, I guess I would just add, too, I think what you just shared in terms of that experience, I think for me, too, getting into this work, very quickly realized that even though I personally hadn't experienced domestic violence myself, the minute we have some awareness about it, I think it's common that we start to see it around us in our families and in our lives. So whether it's coworkers or what have you, and that's, I think, what drew me deeper into this work all those years ago and has kept me involved for 20-plus years. But your question was, what is our role here at the California Partnership?
Yeah, given the enormity of the problem, what's your point of entry and what's on your mind right now, what you're trying to figure out?
Well, our role is the State Domestic Violence Coalition, and there's a coalition just like ours in every state and territory here in the U.S., and each of our coalitions has some common ground and some unique differences just relevant to the state. But really, we serve to represent local domestic violence organizations, advocates, organizers, attorneys, etc., who really recognize that in coming together with a united voice, we're stronger in advocating for public policy and institutional reforms and system change. So that's in a nutshell the broad role that we play here at the California Partnership. And you mentioned one of our local member programs, Haven House. We have a number of programs similar to them all across the state who are providing the frontline life-saving services in communities.
Well, I think it really is true that it's life-saving. It's just a terrifying, it's almost beyond terrifying. I've had a lot of experiences. I mean, anyone who knows women knows about, really, I mean, any cross-section, you know the numbers much better than me, but the number of people who have been experiencing this, the form of being terrorized and terrified and then also being very strong and figuring out so many questions of their own identity and then questions of their children and how great these services are, like Haven House. I wanted to look, Kathy, and ask your opinion. Like, you know, we looked at your site and everything, and you have five demands that we wanted to focus on: restraining order enforcement, addressing language and court access, increased safety for immigrant survivors, improving local dating abuse policies, and strengthen accountability about batterer intervention. It's a complex mix. Tell us what some of those things mean.
Yeah, every year we work with our statewide membership to identify policy priorities for the year. And what you found on our website were some of our priorities from the past years, and we actually just went through a very organic, very grassroots process at our meeting with our statewide membership just a week ago to renew and revisit some of our priorities for the year, and I don't have those in front of me. But as you can see from those priorities that we tend to look at over from year to year, we try to find a blend of strategies and policy priorities which certainly serve the needs of victims and survivors. We really try to focus not only on victim safety and all types of reducing barriers that might get in the way of victims and families being able to get safe, whether it's immigration status or economic justice issues or what have you. And we also try to focus on perpetrator accountability as well as community responsibility for looking at the issue of domestic violence locally as a widespread community issue. So that's kind of in the range of policy priorities that you see that we've looked at in the past. And we do try to, you know, there's so many broad needs and very different depending on what part of the state you're in, but we try to apply an intersectional lens, paying attention to who are the victims and the survivors that are far out in the margins who may have layers and layers of barriers or oppression issues that we need to be paying attention to. And again, looking at issues such as economic justice or immigration rights, and how can we collaborate in coalition with other similar social justice movements to advance some common policy improvements.
Kathy,
the general range of what we try to do from a policy and systems change standpoint.
Well, let's talk a little bit about two things you just raised, because the complexity, and trust me, I and my organization, the Labor Community Strategy Center, we're thinking about this a lot, and we're trying to find the appropriate, as you say, intersection. So let me give you an example. I mean, on one level, there's the issue of these restraining orders, which are, having been through a lot of the processes with women, friends, and family members, you have I've seen some horrible things where a woman is looking right across from the man who battered her, and she chooses to tell the judge she doesn't want the restraining order. We saw with Roger Goodell that he actually brought Janae Rice and Ray Rice into the same room to have that conversation. Of course, the phenomenal difficulty of enforcing a restraining order if someone is a batterer and is, you know, so driven by this desire that, you know, so you have that set of the immediate tactical. And then you have, as you were pointing out, the economic justice, which is, I was just thinking about today, a slogan, you know, I always try to translate everything into a demand organizer. So I said, women get 70% on the dollar because it makes it easier for men to beat them up. You know, that women don't have 100, you know, if women had more economic security, it would not solve the problem. But the issue of economic dependency, it seems to me, is a horrible factor in perpetuating it. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that and how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, I think part of what you're alluding to, perhaps, is also that we need a range of solutions. And whether it's the civil justice system or the criminal legal system, those are some avenues that are necessary and appropriate in some circumstances, and they don't always provide all the solutions we need. So we are trying to advocate for a well-rounded, a comprehensive set of responses. And again, whether it's accessing the legal system or other sorts of remedies or more economic equity and so forth, there's just a range of needs that are out there, and obviously related to the crisis intervention services that our shelters and crisis lines provide. But you see also in the range of what we try to do is also advocate around prevention and trying to work with our local programs, local communities, school boards to think about what are some dating prevention strategies that we can implement in local communities, again, whether it's in schools or whether it's with faith-based organizations, to really try to stem the tide and to focus more on healthy relationships and promoting positive images of masculinity and equitable relationships that are based on respect and so forth. So what I'm getting at is this range of both responses and more prevention approaches that we try to advocate, both on a state level and then in local communities throughout California.
The voice you're listening to is Kathy Moore, the executive director of the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. We're really happy that she's on Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann. One of the things, again, Kathy, that we've been having conversations about is, you know, when I was politically developed in the mid-1960s, I joined something called the Movement, and there was a very fluid conversation in which the main, you know, I've been saying lately that what was the main thing we were working for, the revolution, what was the thing we thought was the problem, the system, what do we think the answer was, the Movement. So we didn't have the same level of issue development, which doesn't mean that there wasn't a women's liberation movement and a gay liberation movement and a black liberation movement, but a certain fluidity if you're working in a community and there is issues of domestic violence and battery on women. There's also the same woman is living in a slum apartment being attacked by her landlord and then goes out and is attacked by the policeman, and then the guy who did or didn't do it is attacked by a policeman who has no concern for domestic violence but wants to impose violence. And then, so it sort of becomes this endless web, which doesn't mean it doesn't have any demands, but it does mean that if we were having a discussion about domestic violence, we would talk more about immigration, right? And the fact that in the middle of this conversation, both people could be deported and sent into ICE centers and their children totally abandoned. So how do you try to navigate the fact that on one level, you need to make very specific demands on the system. On the other level, we all want to start showing up at each other's, not just events, but sort of in each other's lives. How do we understand that as something that I know your group must be talking about?
I think what comes to mind is the art coalition building, perhaps, and that sense we know we have common ground in a lot of these issues and challenges in our communities. And in many ways, due to funding limitations and history and politics and what have you, we find ourselves siloed. And more, we recognize that we have opportunities to work across these different issues, these different silos, with other marginalized groups and other movements. Not only, I don't want to simplify it by just saying what do we have in common, but finding ways to not only invite others into the issue of domestic violence and being part of the solution, and also how do we show up, again, like you said, not just at events, But how do we show up in an advocacy role, whether it's supporting colleagues in legislative policy advocacy or in our practices of how we work across discipline or other movements? Again, I think we've for a long time really wanted to see other systems, other disciplines take an interest in domestic violence and care as much as we do. And at the same time, I think we need to reciprocate by being true partners with other allied movements, I guess. And there's a lot of room for growth and opportunities, and we're really eager to explore how we can do that more in a way that moves toward our common ground, our common interests, but really looks at some of these intersections.
Yeah, and I think that's
an example of that is some legislation that we supported recently. It's AB 1579. Look, and it's called the Healthy Babies Act, and really working with anti-poverty groups, extending CalWORKs benefits so that domestic violence victims are able to access or have some more income security in the crucial pregnancy period when they're experiencing domestic violence. So that's just an example of trying to really reach out and work with anti-poverty groups in a really tangible way this year.
No, I think that's really great. And I think the conversation that is happening, because the Strategy Center is a movement building center. We do anti-racist, anti-imperialist organizing. We doing work on international feminism and trying to understand better. We train and have large numbers of women in the leadership of the organization. It's a very multi-racial, predominantly black and Latino, also bilingual and sometimes trilingual organization. So we're trying to figure out a lot of different things. And one of the things I am being struck by is somehow people seem to be stretching their empathy brain. There seems to be more interest in so-called other people's work and more sense of perception that they're really genuinely, that whether it's climate or, you know, we're not going to defeat this thing. And are you doing climate? Are you doing domestic violence? Or are you doing police brutality? Or are you doing anti-poverty? You know, I mean, there's got to be some ethical, moral convergence that we really care about all these things.
Yeah, I would agree. And my work, obviously, just personally, the 20-plus year career in the domestic violence field, I am very immersed in this field. But I have certainly been hearing for the last several years a great deal of interest and experimentation and trying out and role modeling, and not only amongst our member programs here in California, but amongst our colleagues and other statewide coalitions, this notion, as you talked about, of how do we expand our consciousness, our empathy, and really partner across some of these issues? I think you're right. There's an energy that is increasing, and I'm certainly seeing amongst our constituents and our allies.
Well, let's talk about money. I like talking about money. I mean, there's the nonprofit structures, which we're involved or implicated in, whichever you want to say. And there's also the demands on the government. I was just thinking about, you know, Bill Clinton's ending welfare as we know it. What a cruel, cruel intervention that was. So let's talk about two things. The funding for programs such as yourself, such as Haven House. Let's talk about that, including our listeners out there. What's it like trying to raise money for this? What's the sort of financial structures, and are there foundations supporting this? And where's the money for instance, the expansion of shelters, which is something of the many pieces of the puzzle, you know, having learned about Haven House, that I just sort of have such a visceral affection. Oh, by the way, our organization, the United Auto Workers, here's an example, consistently gave money to Haven House every year. After Kelly Janko, one of our members, we formed a women's committee, and one of the first thing we did is make one of the big issues battery against women and actually funding the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about the issue of trying to raise money in that direction.
Yeah, it's hard to generalize because it's so varied across our state. There certainly is a range of some public sources. They don't stretch far enough, and I can speak to some of the federal and state funding that is available to service organizations, and I can also talk a little bit more about private and corporate contributions from foundations as well as individual giving and community giving. On a national level, we certainly have seen some real important pieces of legislation that have been funding local domestic violence organizations. The Violence Against Women Act, we are just celebrating the 20-year anniversary of that monumental legislation. We're also on the verge of the 30-year anniversary of the Family Violence and Prevention Services Act. Both of these, along with what's called VOCA, which is Victims of Crime Assistance, those three federal funding streams come into the states and then get dispersed to local programs such as Haven House. And, you know, the spread of those dollars vary depending on the community and the different services provided, but those are crucial. And, you know, we're constantly having to monitor and pay attention to those federal sources of dollars and advocate for either increases or to try to minimize against losses when we've had budget crises. Similarly, here in the state of California, the state does allocate some dollars, which are absolutely crucial to primarily shelter services and also some other intervention services, and we work very closely with state agencies around that. There is a limited amount of funding from federal and state sources for domestic violence prevention here in California, but we're hoping to increase that in coming years. But as you've indicated, it's important that we try to have a balance with regards to public and private support for local organizations and services. And we certainly do see some foundation and corporate giving around the area, in this subject area. That really does depend a great deal on your community. More urban areas tend to have more foundation and corporate supports available to them, and we certainly have a lot of local domestic violence agencies in more rural, isolated parts of California that struggle to find those sorts of supports. But, you know, our domestic violence programs really started and are very much supported by local donors. Whether it's individuals who give $5 or $1, I'll tell you, when I used to run a shelter, every single year I received a $1 bill in the mail, and it was anonymous. And it came year after year after year, and I just had to believe that that was probably a donation from a survivor who had stayed in our shelter many years ago. And those contributions are just as important. As you indicated, local groups who do fundraisers, such as Harley owner groups do fundraisers and donate, and such as you talked about, I really, not only from cash contributions, but also in-kind support has certainly been important. And, you know, we very much encourage, as we are on the precipice of October, which is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, it has been for many, many years, we strongly encourage anybody who's interested to really get in touch with their local domestic violence organizations in their communities to talk about volunteering and or contributing in whatever ways you can, because it's those individual supports, whether it's cash or in-kind or volunteering contributions, that really help sustain and move our programs along.
Well, since we know one organization, the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, if people wanted to contribute to your organization, we urge our listeners to sort of say, once you know, you have to act. So every week, if a person has a film, you must go out and see the film. If they're doing organizing, you have to try to do something, as you say. Sometimes just the, I'm sure you know, as an executive director, nobody told you you'd spend half your life fundraising, right? But the fact is that it matters a lot when somebody sends money into the Strategy Center, even at a small amount. It means, oh my God, they actually know about our work. So how could people, if they wanted to, support your work?
That's very kind of you. I appreciate you bringing that up. And because we're not a service delivery organization, it's all the more important that we do have unrestricted contributions that support our advocacy work, whether it's policy advocacy or legislative advocacy or institutional reforms and what have you. So our website is www.cpedv.org. That's CPEDV.org. It's a bit of a mouthful. But if you click through our website and go to the Get Involved page, there's a drop-down that instructs people on how to do, perhaps make an online contribution to our organization. Certainly anybody who's interested could call us at area code 916-444-7163, and we'd be happy to talk more about how to get involved, either contributing to our organization, but also being getting on our list serves when we have policy advocacy that needs to be done, when we need grassroots letter writing support for various pieces of legislation that we're sponsoring or what have you. There are lots of ways to get involved. And if folks contact us, we can also put them in touch with local programs in their own communities as well.
No, I think that's great. So I think I'm not allowed to, as they say, advocate for, but I can I can say to people, if you're very interested, please do check out the website and make your own decisions. But I think one thing that would be exciting is both. 916, I'm assuming, is Sacramento. Is that correct?
It is. We're a statewide organization, but our office is based in Sacramento.
So there's both helping at the statewide level, and there's also, I assume, that if people like would type in a zip code and write you a note saying, I want to both support your work and support something in my own area, that you would have referrals to other groups at the local level doing important work as well. Is that true, Kathy?
Yes, that is true.
Okay, yes, folks, so you get the drill, right? You've been listening to Kathy Moore, the Executive Director of the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. Do go out and check out their website. I know, having been on the other side of it, just an email saying that you heard her on the show, that you're interested in the work, would mean a lot. And you can figure it out from there. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM. Kathy, you get the last word.
Well, thank you. You know, one other way that folks can get involved is really honoring and taking action around October, which, again, is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And we have launched a social media campaign. Our goal is in October to turn the Golden State purple, which has long been the color for domestic violence awareness. So if you go to our website, you'll find information about our Intercept DV Challenge, and we're encouraging folks to take the Intercept DV pledge and get involved with domestic violence locally. And there's more information on our website about that. But October is really a chance to take action around domestic violence and be part of the movement to make it change.
And also, I was to add, Kathy, that our producer, Crystal McMillan, and we have a really terrific website we'd like you to check out, which is www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And folks, we'll have some information on that. Kathy, you should know that the interview will be up on the site in a day or two for download. We're going to try to also have transcripts of it. And please try to use the site and refer people to it and do everything you can to have this interview help you work.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting us to this conversation, and I really appreciate your long-term concern and care and advocacy. I appreciate it a great deal.
Take good care of yourself.
Thanks, you too.
So I want to thank all our listeners. I want to thank Kathy Moore, the Executive Director of the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. So take good care of yourself. I'll see you next Tuesday at 4. And I think is that thing they used to say, all power to the people.